Usually, when we think about capturing a memory, it's this incredibly subjective, fluid thing, right? Like you remember a summer afternoon and your brain paints it with this golden glow, blurring out the details you don't care about or amplifying the things you do.
Oh, for sure. Human memory is notorious for being an unreliable narrator. We alter the past, every single time we pull it up to look at it.
Exactly. But then you introduce a mechanical device into the equation, a box that simply opens its eye for a fraction of a second and traps the light exactly as it was in that very instant.
Right.
And suddenly we're not just relying on the murky waters of memory anymore. We are actually recording visual truth.
It is, the absolute definition of an objective shift in human history. We went from interpreting the world through memory and paint to physically capturing the actual photons bouncing off of it.
It's wild to think about. And at its core, whether it's a 100-year-old brass antique or, the sleek glass rectangle in your pocket, every single camera you have ever seen is basically just a dark box.
Yep, just a dark box.
A dark box that lets a controlled amount of light hit a sensitive surface. So, for today's deep dive, we are decoding the actual magic behind that click you make every day.
I love this topic because the camera really represents a perfect intersection of so many different scientific disciplines over time.
How so?
Well, it starts with pure physics, right? Understanding how light travels and bends. Then it moves into chemistry with the development of light-sensitive materials. And
The
eventually,
crashes right into computer science.
exactly.
Yeah.
But before we can even talk about the wild shapes and sizes cameras have taken over the centuries, we really need to understand how they pull off this trick of trapping light in the first place.
Right, the whole mechanism is built around exposure control. And the first major player in that process is the aperture.
Yes, the aperture.
The easiest analogy for the aperture is right in your own face. It's the pupil of an eye.
That's a great way to put it.
If you walk into a pitch black room, your pupil dilates. It gets incredibly wide to let in as much ambient light as possible so you don't, trip over a coffee table. Walk out into bright midday sunlight, and your pupil shrinks down to a tiny dot so you don't blind yourself. The camera's aperture does the exact same thing, using overlapping metal blades to physically widen or narrow the opening inside the lens.
Yeah, and in photography, the size of that opening expands and contracts in these standard increments called f-stops.
Oh, the f-stops.
Yeah, the numbering system that trips up almost everyone who is new to the subject, because it seems completely backward at first glance.
It really does.
The numbers typically range from, say, f1.4 up to f32. The catch is that the smaller the number, like f1.4, the wider the opening.
Which feels entirely counterintuitive. I mean, why would a tiny number mean a massive opening and a huge number like 32 mean a tiny pinhole?
Right, because it's actually a fraction. The F stands for focal length. So when you see F2, you're actually looking at the fraction 1/2.
Oh, okay.
When you see F32, you're looking at 1/32. A half is a much larger slice of pie than a 32nd. So an F1.4 opening is letting in a massive amount of light, and an F32 opening is barely letting in a sliver.
That makes so much more sense. It's literally just basic fractions.
Exactly.
And every time you move up a standard increment, say from F4 to F5.6, you are halving the amount of light that enters the camera.
Correct.
But the aperture isn't just a dimmer switch, right? It also dictates depth of field, which is the distance range in your photo where objects appear perfectly sharp and clear.
Yes, this is where it gets really artistic.
Right. If you use a really wide opening, a large correction like F1.4, you get a very narrow depth of field. Your subject, maybe a person's face, is tack sharp, but the background behind them just melts into this beautiful, creamy blur.
And that shallow depth of field happens because the wide opening forces light rays to enter the lens from much steeper angles.
Okay.
The glass has a harder time bending all those extreme angles to a single deep focal point. So only a thin slice of the world is sharp.
Makes sense.
Conversely, if you shrink that aperture down to a tiny fraction like F32, you force the light to only come straight through the center of the lens. The angles are shallow, the light rays are highly organized, and your depth of field increases massively.
So everything is in focus.
Exactly. Everything from the flower right in front of the lens all the way to the mountains miles in the background will appear sharp.
Wow. Okay, so the aperture is only half of the mechanical equation for letting light into that dark box. The other half is the shutter,
Right, a shutter.
which is like the eyelid. It determines how long the light-sensitive surface at the back of the camera is actually exposed to the light coming through the lens.
Yeah, and there are basically two main mechanical ways to build a shutter. First, you have the leaf-type shutter. Think of a circular iris diaphragm, held under spring tension, sitting right inside the lens itself. When you press the button, it rapidly snaps open and closed.
But then you have the much more common focal plane shutter.
Yeah.
This one doesn't sit inside the lens. It operates right up close to the film or the digital sensor at the back of the camera. It's basically two metal plates or cloth curtains that pass across the light-sensitive surface.
This mechanism is brilliant, but it is fundamentally strange when you really look at it.
How so?
Well, at fast speeds, the first curtain starts opening, and before it even finishes crossing the frame, the second curtain follows right behind it. You essentially have a moving slit of light traveling across the sensor.
A moving slit.
Okay.
Which introduces a wild physics quirk called the rolling shutter effect, right?
Yes, exactly.
Like, if you take a picture of an airplane propeller spinning at high speed using a focal plane shutter, the propeller blades look bent or completely detached in the final image.
Right, because the moving slit of light is exposing the top of the photo slightly before it exposes the bottom.
Ah.
The propeller physically moved during the tiny fraction of second it took for that slit to travel down the frame.
That is so crazy. Even with those quirks, the speed of these shutters is astonishing. I mean, exposure times can range from several minutes for a dark night shot, all the way down to 1/1000th of a second.
Yeah, the range is incredible.
Like a long exposure of a waterfall turns the rushing water into a smooth, misty cloud because the water is continuously moving while the shutter is open. But a 1/1000th of a second exposure freezes a speeding car or a hummingbird's wings in midair.
Right.
But wait, I have a practical question here. If I want to freeze a fast-moving object, I need that super fast shutter. But if the shutter is barely open,
because you just cut your incoming light in half with the faster shutter speed, you must compensate by doubling the size of the aperture opening, moving down exactly one f-stop fraction.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, if you have the time, but double the opening, the exact same volume of light hits the sensor.
It perfectly balances out, and modern cameras do a lot of this heavy lifting for us using built-in light meters. The source material mentions through the lens, or TTL metering.
Yeah, TTL standard now.
Inside the camera, a panel of light-sensitive semiconductors measures the light coming in through the lens in real time. The camera's microprocessor looks at the scene and averages all the light and dark areas out to a specific decline, which is 18% middle gray.
And that specific percentage is fascinating.
Yeah.
Camera engineers needed a universal baseline to tell the light meter what a normal exposure should look like.
Why 18% though?
Studies of the physical world showed that if you take a typical landscape, like a mix of bright sky, dark shadows, green foliage, human skin tones, and you just blend it all together into a mush, the scene reflects roughly 18% of the light hitting it.
Wow.
So the camera basically just assumes whatever you are pointing it at averages out to 18% gray.
Which explains why taking a photo of a snowy landscape can be so frustrating.
Oh, absolutely.
The camera looks at all that blinding white snow, assumes the world is far too bright, and automatically darkens the exposure to drag it back down to 18% gray. You end up with a picture of dull gray snow unless you manually override it.
It's a perfect example of the machine blindly following its physical programming.
Exactly. But, you know, getting the exact right amount of light into the box doesn't matter if the light is just recording a bright, blurry blob. The light needs to be organized.
Right.
And that brings us to the optical precision of lenses.
A camera lens is almost never just a single curved piece of glass.
Hmm.
It is a complex assembly of multiple optical elements meticulously shaped to bend the light rays so they converge perfectly on the film plane.
Because light is incredibly messy.
Extremely messy. If you just used a simple magnifying glass, you'd get severe optical distortions.
Like chromatic aberration.
Exactly. Chromatic aberration is basically a failure of the lens to focus all the colors of light at the exact same point.
Okay.
Different color wavelengths travel at different speeds through glass, meaning they bend at different angles. Blue light bends sharper than red light.
And what happens if you don't fix that?
Without correction, you end up with weird, glowing purple and green color fringes around the edges of objects in your photo.
Oh, I've definitely seen that in cheap cameras. So camera engineers design multiple internal lens elements made of different types of glass to deliberately cancel out those physical distortions. You force the blue light to bend back and meet the red light.
Exactly. It's an optical puzzle.
And there are two broad categories of lenses we should talk about here. Zoom lenses and prime lenses.
Right.
Zoom lenses let you twist the barrel, physically moving the internal glass elements back and forth to change the focal length. You can zoom in on a subject from across the street without taking a single step forward.
Very convenient.
But prime lenses have a fixed focal length. They don't zoom at all. You have to basically zoom with your feet by physically walking closer to or further from your subject.
Now, you might wonder why anyone would intentionally buy a lens that forces them to walk back and forth instead of just twisting a dial.
Yeah, it seems like a downgrade.
The answer is optical superiority. Because a zoom lens has to manage all those moving parts and varied focal length, it has to make optical compromises. A prime lens is engineered to do exactly one thing at one focal length.
So it's specialized.
Exactly. The image quality is vastly superior. They're sharper, and crucially, they can open their apertures much wider, making their low-light performance absolutely stellar.
Okay, so we have this incredible multi-element lens focusing the light onto the back of the camera. But catching a perfectly lit, sharply focused image is completely useless if the photographer accidentally points the lens at the wrong thing.
Which used to happen a lot.
Right. And that introduces the engineering nightmare of the viewfinder. Historically, viewfinders suffered from a deeply frustrating physical limitation called parallax error.
Parallax error happens because there is a physical misalignment between what the little viewing window sees and what the actual taking lens captures. On older cameras, you'd look through a small glass square on the top left of the camera body, but the lens taking the photo was sitting dead center.
Right. To understand how annoying this is, try holding your finger right in front of your nose. Close your left eye and look at the background behind your finger. Now, open your left eye and close your right eye. The background completely shifts.
Yep.
The viewing angles are physically offset. If you're photographing a mountain range miles away, that slight offset doesn't really matter. But if you're taking a close-up portrait of a friend from 2 feet away,
what looks perfectly centered in your top left viewfinder might result in chopping the top of your friend's head off in the final picture because the actual lens is positioned lower down.
That sounds infuriating.
It was. That parallax problem was so disruptive that it drove entire eras of camera engineering. Designers created wildly different camera shapes specifically to solve it.
And the ultimate dominant solution to the parallax error was the single lens reflex, or SLR, camera.
The SLR completely solved the parallax issue by using a brilliant trick. A front surfaced mirror placed at a 45-degree angle right in the optical path behind the lens.
Okay.
The light enters the taking lens, hits that mirror, bounces up into a glass pentaprism on the top of the camera, and then shoots straight out the viewfinder to your eye. You are looking precisely through the very lens that will take the picture.
So what you see is 100% exactly what you will get. No more chopped off heads.
Exactly.
But wait, if that physical mirror is sitting right behind the lens, bouncing light up to my eye, isn't it physically blocking the film at the back of the camera?
Oh, you caught that.
Yeah. How does the light hit the film to take the picture without the mirror getting in the way?
You have zeroed in on the exact quirky reality of the SLR mechanism. To expose the film, that viewing mirror has to mechanically slap up and out of the way for a fraction of a second. It is a momentary blindness precisely at the moment of capture.
Seriously?
Seriously. When you press the shutter button, the mirror flips up, your viewfinder goes completely pitch black, the shutter curtains slide open and close to expose the film, and then the mirror drops back down.
That sounds incredibly disorienting if you are trying to track a moving subject, like, say, a race car or a bird.
It was a huge source of friction. Early SLRs were so clunky that the mirror actually stayed locked up in the roof of the camera until you physically wound the film to the next frame.
So you were just staring into total blackness after every single shot.
It's exactly. The introduction of the instant return mirror in the 1950s, where Japanese engineers figured out how to make the mirror automatically slap up and drop back down in milliseconds, was a massive milestone. It minimized that blindness and made action photography viable.
And there were so many other wild mechanical formats designed to solve these exact framing problems, like the massive large format view cameras with those long extendable accordion bellows.
Oh, the classics.
Yeah, they used huge sheets of film and were primarily used for architectural photography because you could physically tilt the lens independently from the film back.
Yeah.
That corrected the perspective lines so tall buildings didn't look like they were falling over backward in the photo.
We also saw twin lens reflex cameras. Instead of a flipping internal mirror, they stacked two identical lenses right on top of each other.
Right.
The bottom lens exposed the film, and the top lens bounced a permanent image up onto a viewing screen you looked down into from above.
Which is such a weird posture to take a photo from. And at the opposite end of the spectrum, you had sub-miniature cameras, notoriously used for espionage. Some used film barely 8 millimeters wide to secretly copy documents.
Pure James Bond stuff.
Right. So we've built the ultimate light trapping box, and we've perfected the glass to focus the light. But what is actually catching that light? For over a century, that canvas was analog photographic film.
And photographic film is pure chemical alchemy. The surface of the film is coated in a gelatin emulsion containing millions of microscopic silver halide crystals.
This is where the physics and chemistry actually crash into each other.
Exactly.
When a photon of light comes through the camera lens and strikes one of those silver halide crystals, it physically alters it. The light energy knocks an electron loose, which combines with a silver ion to form a microscopic speck of black metallic silver.
Right. The brighter the light hitting an area of the film, the more metallic silver specks are formed.
Yeah.
But here's the crazy part. You can't see this happen?
Wait, you can't.
No, it forms what is called a latent image. An invisible chemical blueprint of the photograph burned into the emulsion.
Oh, wow. So to actually see the image, you have to plunge the film into a chemical developer bath in total darkness.
Yep.
The developer seeks out those microscopic specks of exposed silver and exponentially multiplies them, darkening the areas where the light hit. It was an entire process of delayed gratification. You didn't know if you actually captured the moment or if you, you know, left the lens cap on until hours or days later.
And that entire paradigm of manual labor, chemical baths, and delayed gratification was obliterated by the digital revolution.
Absolutely obliterated.
And the foundational digital shift happened much earlier than most people realize.
Yeah, this part of the source material is amazing. In 1975, an engineer named Steven Sasson built the first working digital camera prototype. And the historical irony here is that he worked for Kodak, the absolute kings of the analog chemical film empire.
Yeah, Kodak. Sasson utilized a relatively new technology called a charge-coupled device, or CCD sensor. This sensor discarded the silver halide crystals entirely. Instead, it converted incoming photons directly into electrical charges.
The specs of this prototype are staggering by today's standards. It captured a resolution of 0.1 megapixels.
Oh, it was so primitive.
Sasson basically built a digital Frankenstein. He cobbled together parts from a movie camera to make the lens and the body. And since memory cards were decades away from existing, this massive, heavy contraption saved the digital data onto a standard audio cassette tape.
A cassette tape.
Yes. It took 23 seconds just to write the image to the tape. To actually look at the photo, you had to pull the cassette out, put it in a separate custom-built tape reader, and view it on a television monitor.
It's wild. Kodak possessed the foundational technology for digital photography in the 1970s. But because their entire global monopoly was built on selling chemical film and photographic paper, they dragged their feet on commercializing it.
A fatal mistake.
Truly. By 2003, digital camera sales officially surpassed film cameras in the United States. Photography had fundamentally shifted from a scarce physical chemical resource to an infinite instantaneous electrical one.
And as the digital era progressed, the sensors evolved. We moved away from those early CCD sensors. A CCD sensor basically operates like a massive bucket brigade.
Right.
It reads the electrical charge of the pixels by passing the data down the line row by row to a single amplifier at the corner of the chip.
And that bucket brigade method produced great images. But passing the data down the line took a tremendous amount of electrical power and was inherently slow.
Okay.
Plus, if you pointed a CCD camera at a really bright light, the buckets would literally overflow with electrical charge, spilling into the adjacent rows and creating these ugly bright streaks across the image.
Oh, I remember those streaks on early digital videos, which is why the industry shifted to CMOS sensors, complementary metal oxide semiconductor chip.
The brilliance of the CMOS sensor is that instead of a bucket brigade, every single pixel on the grid gets its own tiny microscopic amplifier.
Wow. Every single one.
Every single one. The camera can read the electrical value of every pixel simultaneously and independently.
That structural change drastically lowered power consumption and allowed for incredibly fast frame rates. It's the technology that makes it possible to shoot continuous high-definition video on a battery-powered device without draining it in 5 minutes.
Exactly.
And the miniaturization of those highly efficient CMOS sensors paved the way for the most significant shift in modern photography history. Taking this light-trapping box, shrinking it down to the size of a fingernail, and putting it in another device entirely.
The smartphone camera. It made photography a ubiquitous everyday activity for billions of people almost overnight.
It really did.
The historical marker here is the Sharp JSH04, introduced in Japan in the year 2000 as the world's first widely available digital camera phone.
And let's be honest, those early camera phone pictures looked like heavily pixelated, muddy smears.
Oh, they were terrible.
But today, we have smartphones capturing stunning, professional-level images. But wait, we just spent 20 minutes talking about massive glass lens elements, fixing optical distortions, physical irises opening and closing for depth of field, and the math of the exposure triangle.
Right.
Smartphone lenses are physically tiny. They don't have moving metal aperture blades or long focal lengths. Are our phones basically faking it to get good photos?
They absolutely are. But they're faking it using some of the most advanced computer science on the planet.
Okay.
This is the era of computational photography. Because a smartphone cannot physically fit a large format piece of glass or a massive image sensor inside a chassis that is only millimeters thick, it uses software algorithms and artificial intelligence to digitally simulate the physics we've been discussing.
That is wild. So when you press the shutter button on your phone, you think you were taking one picture. In reality, the camera has likely just taken a rapid-fire series of photos in a fraction of a second, all at varying exposure levels.
Exactly. It captures the really dark details, the perfectly lit middle details, and the super bright details simultaneously.
Which is high dynamic range, or HDR.
Right. The phone's processor instantly analyzes all those frames and physically stitches the best exposed pixels together to create an image that a traditional mechanical camera would deeply struggle to capture in a single shot.
Your phone also uses complex AI depth sensing. Remember how a wide f1.4 aperture creates that beautiful, creamy, blurred background because of how the thick glass bends the light?
Yes.
A tiny phone lens physically cannot achieve that shallow depth of field on its own. Everything from the subject to the background should be perfectly sharp.
So the software maps out the scene in three dimensions.
Okay.
It uses machine learning to recognize the edges of a human face or a pet, digitally cuts the subject out like a pair of scissors, and then artificially applies a mathematical blur filter to the background pixels to simulate the physics of a large, expensive prime lens.
It's all just math.
Just math. Add in optical image stabilization, where tiny electromagnets literally float the lens to counteract the microscopic shaking of your hands in low light. And you realize you aren't really holding a camera anymore. You are holding a supercomputer that happens to have a lens attached to it.
It is genuinely mind-blowing. We've gone from standing under a dark cloth behind a wooden box on a tripod relying on chemical alchemy to bouncing light off instant return mirrors to solve parallax errors,
right,
all the way to a Kodak engineer building a Frankenstein cassette tape prototype. And it all culminates in an AI-powered chip sitting in your pocket that seamlessly manipulates data to give you a perfectly exposed picture in the dark.
The evolution of the camera is really the story of humanity building increasingly complex tools just to stop time for a fraction of a second.
Beautifully said. The next time you pull out your phone to snap a quick photo of your lunch or your dog doing something goofy, take a second to appreciate it. You are holding centuries of physics, chemistry, and engineering all culminating in that split-second click. It really is a magical box.
But that magic leaves us with a fascinating philosophical puzzle to chew on.
Oh, what's that?
If modern computational photography relies on invisible algorithms to combine multiple exposures, mathematically fix low lighting, and artificially blur backgrounds based on what an AI thinks the subject is the camera still an objective tool that captures visual truth, as we talked about at the beginning? Or is it starting to interpret reality for us?